This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up, polio has returned to the United States, and we'll have the latest on the spread. But first, at least two animals now in Wisconsin have contracted the West Nile virus. The mosquito-borne disease is transmissible to humans, but even if you do contract it, you're unlikely to develop symptoms. Rebecca Osborne's a vector-borne disease epidemiologist at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. And Rebecca, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
How dangerous is the West Nile to humans?
Well, like you mentioned, the large majority of people that are infected with the virus will probably not even realize that they've been infected because it often doesn't cause any symptoms. But for about one in every 150 people that becomes infected will go on to develop what we call West Nile encephalitis or severe disease and might end up in the hospital. So it can be very serious in a certain proportion of people.
What about our pets, Rebecca?
Yeah, good question. So the animals that are most affected by West Nile virus include horses. So people who do own horses are probably familiar with a vaccine that's available to prevent West Nile virus disease in their horses. Otherwise, it generally infects wild birds, which is how the virus ends up being transmitted to mosquitoes in the first place.
Can it only be transmitted from mosquitoes? I mean, could there be an infected animal transmitting it to another animal or even, say, a human?
So it's only a spread from birds to mosquitoes.
Okay.
So that's how mosquitoes become infected in the first place. That mosquito could then go on to bite a person or a horse, for example, and make that animal sick. But a person who gets West Nile virus can't do a very good job of infecting a mosquito. So really it's the birds that are giving the virus to the mosquitoes, and that mosquito might go on and bite someone else, like a horse or a human.
Rebecca Osborne joining us from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, a vector-borne disease epidemiologist. And I feel like it hasn't been a really bad mosquito season, at least here in south central Wisconsin. And I also feel like, well, fall's encroaching on us, and maybe mosquito season is in our back rearview mirror. Vector-borne disease epidemiologist, how do you see the news of West Nile virus found in two animals in Wisconsin?
Yeah, this is the time of year when people sort of have their sights set on fall.
Right.
School is starting. You know, the weather's sort of hinting at a change, but this is still sort of peak West Nile virus season through the end of the month, generally, depending on weather. So really, August and September are the time of the year when we see the most number of West Nile virus cases in both animals and people.
Huh.
It's been a quiet year so far, right? We just had a couple animals that have been reported, but we know it's out there. We know it's in the mosquitoes. Probably some people are being exposed that may not be getting sick, but unfortunately, it's probably just a matter of time before we start seeing a few human cases pop up.
Do we know why?
To think about it until it's sort of a really cold frost, and then we can forget about mosquitoes for the year.
All right, so the frost is what we're waiting for, but why is the risk of getting this West Nile virus the highest at the end of summer, Rebecca?
Yeah, so that's a great question with a really complex answer, but there's a lot of different things that can affect how risky it is to get West Nile virus. But one of the main things that can contribute to risk in people is a really high temperature. This can affect how quickly the virus replicates or sort of becomes transmissible in the mosquito. And it can even, change the mosquito's behavior and how often they take blood meals or bite a person. So August and September, on average, are really hot months for Wisconsin. And even in the end of July. So that really is affecting the number of infected mosquitoes that are flying around outside. That's why the risk is highest this time of year.
What are you doing to prevent mosquito bites? What can we do to stave off a West Nile virus spread?
Sure. So one of the best things to do is to just think about preventing bites when you go outside. The time that these mosquitoes that spread West Nile virus are most active is at dawn and dusk. So this is going to be the most important times of day to protect yourself. And that would be, wearing a mosquito repellent. My favorite is a product that includes picaridin, which is a kind of EPA or Environmental Protection Agency registered repellent. There's other common ones like DEET, but there are several options that work really well against mosquito bites. The other thing to do is just cover up your skin. So if you can bear it, even if it's really hot, wear sort of long sleeve, loose fitting clothing that can keep the mosquitoes from getting to your skin. And then just again, avoiding those peak biting times at dawn and dusk.
Yeah, I usually use the DEET. So I wanted to ask you again, Rebecca, about the insect repellent that you use. What's it called?
My favorite is called picaridin. It's an active ingredient that's found in a variety of different products.
Thank you.
There are others. You can check on the EPA website if you just look for repellents. They have a great website that has a lot of options that are, again, registered with the Environmental Protection Agency.
Rebecca Osborne from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services taking a look at the West Nile virus, which has been found in two animals in Wisconsin. And what do West Nile virus symptoms look like, Rebecca? In humans who show symptoms, what could we expect?
Yeah, so in a lot of people, it might cause a mild flu-like illness, a flu for a few days. So body aches, chills, fever, headache, muscle pains. And a lot of people will just get that.
We're kind of cutting out there. So just to reiterate here, Rebecca says it would be flu-like symptoms. And if you do have those symptoms, you should consult a physician immediately. And that would be the symptoms to look for. And Rebecca, do we have you back?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. So I was just saying some of the symptoms to look for in humans, it would be like a flu-like symptoms. And what to do if you were to come down with those symptoms, I would imagine wouldn't be different than any other time you'd have those symptoms.
Yeah, certainly contact your healthcare provider if you start to feel really sick and aren't feeling better after a few days. And if you have more serious symptoms like, you know, confusion and memory loss and balance issues, things that are really concerning for the more severe presentation of West Nile virus, certainly call your doctor right away.
But it would, like so many things in our health system, prevention would be the best medicine in this regard.
Absolutely. Yep. So just taking a few steps to prevent bites is excellent, as well as trying to keep standing water away from your home. One other thing to think about, mosquitoes love to breed in water. So tip those containers, you know, clean out your buckets and drains and make sure there's not a lot of standing water around your house.
Well, Rebecca Osborne, you give us a reason to look forward to our first frost.
Yes, that is one reason to look forward to winter is the saying goodbye to mosquitoes.
Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you again.
Rebecca Osborne, vector-borne disease epidemiologist at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, talking with us about what you need to know about the West Nile virus in Wisconsin. Now, it's time for Wisconsin Life, and here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about the healing power of nature.
Sometimes, an ordinary experience surprises us, turning the mundane into something extraordinary. Writer Crystal Chan felt this on a walk she took in her neighborhood with a friend, reminding them of the power of being present and enjoying the moment.
It was supposed to be a typical evening walk. My friend Zach was visiting from Manitowoc, and when I told him about the pond in our Oshkosh neighborhood, he wanted to see it. What I call the pond is a retention pond for an originally low-lying area in our neighborhood. The city created the pond in order to prevent people's basements from flooding. Mallard ducks congregated there in the summer, and as the autumn drew on, the ducks were replaced by geese. Zach and I walked to the pond at dusk. As we rounded the corner to the pond, we heard them. Geese. All spring and summer, I had seen only a couple geese at a time. Now, there were maybe 50, and they were flying, making wide circles around the pond, honk-talking to each other as they flew. As the last of the sky's color faded into night, the geese continued to make wide, low circles, honking, flapping powerfully, mere feet over our heads. I thought that the geese were just going to circle low to the ground, and that would have been magic enough. But as night settled in full, we heard more honking far in the distance. More geese were coming. Zach and I watched on silently. The original flock of 50 geese were still circling above us. Then a single goose silently landed on the water and cried out, honking to the others. "Maybe that one is a scout," Zach whispered. And sure enough, within moments, the 50 bodies of muscle and wing skidded onto the surface of the water. Moments later, the second wave of honking was above us, another dark flock. The geese, already on the water, cried back in a cacophony of noise until the flying group also skid-landed on the surface. After that, a third flock circled in, honking, more skid-landing. 150 geese, then 200 of them. Only a thin strip of light shone from a parking lot lamp, a sliver of visibility. And in this sliver, we saw a density of powerful bodies on the pond. Beyond this thin sliver of illumination, darkness. But we knew that it was not just darkness. We knew there were hundreds of wild animals mere yards away. The power of their presence was tangible. It is not unsurprising that our experience rendered itself as utmost holiness in this COVID world. These days, presence is fleeting. We have all been presence starved. You can't see this inner starvation, but it's there. As the night grew thick, I couldn't see Zach a couple feet away from me, but I could feel his presence. Just as I couldn't see the 200 powerful bodies upon the pond, but I could feel their presence. It was a visceral, primal sensing of presence, one that surpassed any Zoom meeting, one that fed the heart and spirit. At some point, the geese grew quiet and there was silence. In the thick darkness, Zach and I couldn't see them at all. But the power of their presence was overwhelming and palpable in the silence of that night. And in some deep and indescribable way, it healed a hungry, hidden part of us.
Writer Crystal Chan brought you that story about the healing power of nature. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Polio, an incurable disease that affects mostly children, is circulating in New York State. After decades of presumed eradication in the United States, the World Health Organization has put us on the list of countries where polio is now circulating. One out of 200 polio infections cause irreversible paralysis, and 5 to 10% of children paralyzed by polio will die from the disease. Rosemary Rochford is a professor of immunology and microbiology at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, and she joins us next. Rosemary, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
What do we know about these confirmed polio cases in New York State? What are the details here?
We only have one case of polio of a young man who was not vaccinated and developed paralytic polio, so he's paralyzed due to the infection. But we've detected the virus itself in the wastewater in at least 4 counties so far.
4 counties across New York, and so what does that mean from the view of immunology and microbiology? What does that portend?
What it portends is it means that there's a lot of people that are infected with this virus that are shedding it in their feces. They don't know they're infected, but they're still able to spread it. So in areas where there's very low vaccination rate, like in some counties, there's 60 to 70% people are vaccinated. That means 30% are not. They're going to be susceptible to getting infected with poliovirus if they get in contact with somebody who is infected but might not even know it.
So we don't have definitive numbers outside of the one known case that has been identified in New York State. What does that mean for dealing with an outbreak of polio, Rosemary?
What it means is we need to get as many people vaccinated as possible. When we used to have polio circulating in this country back in the 1950s and we'd have epidemics every year, We developed the vaccine in the 1950s and then another one in the 1960s and dropped the cases down in the 1970s. We had less than 10 cases in the U.S. and it was eliminated. So vaccines prevent prevent this virus from spreading in this country. So that's really the only tool we have, and it's a great tool.
Rosemary Rochford, professor of immunology and microbiology at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. And how is this polio spread? How infectious is it?
It's very infectious. It's spread not by respiratory, like we think about with COVID right now. People can have it through their breathing, but it's through contamination with objects. So say you go to the bathroom, you don't wash your hands so well, right? And it can be lingering on your fingertips and you touch a glass and somebody else picks that up. So through contaminated objects is really one of the key ways, or person to person is another key way for it to be transmitted.
We just talked about the West Nile virus in Wisconsin, Rosemary, and how people who have contracted the West Nile virus may not know it. Many of them, most of them, would not even be symptomatic. How does that play out for polio? When people contract polio, the polio virus, do they know it?
Well, actually, there's a range of things, just like with any kind of infectious disease. Some people are infected and we call them asymptomatic. They have no symptoms, so they don't know. Some people might be infected and get kind of a stiff neck, kind of sort of flu-like symptoms. And then some people can go on to develop that paralysis. So there's a range of symptoms that people can experience. And sometimes they might confuse that kind of illness, not feeling so good, crummy kind of feeling with something else, but it could be due to polio.
And but the question would be, are you vaccinated against polio though, right? Because if you're vaccinated, I would imagine your concerns are diminished to none. If you are not, I would imagine this would be an opportunity for you to do so.
Yeah, it would be definitely an opportunity to do so. And in fact, I just had my sister was asking me if her kids were reaching out to her to say, have we been vaccinated? And in this country, most states require children to be vaccinated against polio when they go to public schools. But a lot of people have chosen not to vaccinate their children. And so now would be a good time to take advantage of that vaccination. It's a very, very safe vaccine.
So as I understand it, Rosemary, this is the first polio case that's originated in the United States since 1979. What does this say about where we are right now with the routine childhood vaccinations that you've been talking about today?
Well, I have to say, somebody who studied these viruses and tried to think about how to prevent them, to realize for the viruses, we do have tools to prevent them, that people aren't taking advantage of those tools. And also, you know, with COVID, a lot of people, haven't been out to the regular vaccines just because people were indoors for a while, not moving about. But there's really this anti-vaccine campaign spreading falsehoods about sort of what can happen has been a real challenge for public health officials to try to get people to say, these are important. And we've forgotten how serious it can be with polio, right? We don't have images for most of us of people, of children in wheelchairs or in iron lungs.
Yeah, it was such a big deal for most of the early part of the 20th century. As we look back on that time, what should we learn from that history that we should bring to the fore here today?
Well, I would say that public health is really important. We've forgotten the value of that. And I also want to really emphasize that you might not worry about contracting polio for yourself, but what if you're asymptomatic, so you don't know you're sick and you spread it? There's people that don't have any good immune system children sometimes have missing parts of their immune system not working so well, and they're really susceptible. So when you get vaccinated with polio, you protect not only yourself, but you can protect your community. And we really need to have enough people in a community vaccinated to protect them.
We heard some of those same arguments when it came to the COVID vaccine, and yet we've still seen vaccine hesitancy, whether it be with COVID and now with some of the numbers we're seeing in an outbreak of polio, the polio virus in New York State. So from your perspective of immunology and microbiology, Rosemary Rochford, what can we do in this regard to beat back vaccine hesitancy or to argue on behalf of the efficacy of vaccines? What role do we play in the grand scheme of public health here?
I think I have a phrase that I was thinking about this when we were talking about with COVID and people were worried about it. And I said, to protect your community, you get your immunity. And I really, it's our, you know, as we think about being public minded and civic minded for our community, that's really one thing we can start helping people to do. And I also think, you know, those of us in immunology and microbiology, we're always happy to talk to people and understand people's concerns about vaccine. I think they're really, I appreciate that there can be concerns about that. And I think I don't want to dismiss those concerns, but I certainly would love to have the chance to address those concerns.
Rosemary Rashford, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
And we're just out of time. Rosemary is a professor of immunology and microbiology at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, and she talked with us today about polio cases in New York State, about the lag in routine childhood vaccination in recent years. And if you've got more about this, you are always welcome to join the conversation and keep it going on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also email us ideas@wpr.org and let us know your thoughts, and those thoughts may make it to the air sometime tomorrow or in the near future. Build a list of the classic movies that must not be missed. But first, the brand new economy of paying collegiate student athletes to use their name, image, and likeness. Last week, we saw the launch of an outfit billing itself as the first donor-led image, name, and likeness organization for the University of Wisconsin athletes called the Varsity Collective. Now, the collective joins a confusing and potentially lucrative landscape and new era in collegiate and labor history where regulations are, at least for now, few and far between. So how are other colleges, other student athletes navigating these still very uncharted waters? You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Do you agree or disagree with the concept of compensating student athletes? Do you like the current name, image, likeness allowance by the NCAA? And would you like to see the Wisconsin legislature or the U.S. Congress take action to regulate income for collegiate athletes who are enrolled in college? Are you a current or former student athlete or a parent of one? I'd love to get your thoughts this afternoon and some perspective on all of this. Join us, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email anytime ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is Ellen Starowski, professor of sports media in the Roy H. Park School of Communications at Ithaca College. Her research includes gender equity and Title IX, pay equity and equal employment opportunity, college athletes' rights, and the exploitation of college athletes. She is the co-author of the book College Athletes for Hire, The Evolution and Legacy of the NCAA Amateur Myth. Ellen, welcome to Central Time.
I'm so happy to be with you today, Lee.
Let's start with the Supreme Court decision that made this all possible. It came out last year and it gave college athletes the ability to profit off, well, themselves. How much of a sea change was this?
You know, it's interesting, depending on your historical perspective. I personally don't regard this as being a revolutionary kind of thing. To me, it's more of a restoration of economic rights that have been stripped away from college athletes over the span of many years. And if we go back and we look at the early 1900s, for example, athletes had the opportunity for the kind of endorsements that they're getting now. So it's very interesting to think about this over a 100-year period of time that it took us this long to come back to an economic right that they already should have had all of those many, many years.
So what do these rights mean? I mean, after the Supreme Court ruling last year, it could have would have expected perhaps some regulations, the NCAA to establish some guidelines in this space. Did they?
Very loosely, I would say, you know, so they set up some stipulations that said that college athletes could not be compensated for play. That was the way in which they framed that, that it needed to be money that was coming from outside of the institution rather than inside the institution. So money coming from third parties, for example. There were those kinds of what they were referring to as guardrails. In terms of where we're at right now, you know, you mentioned the Varsity Collective, and that's one of, you know, just, you know, approximately 120 around the country. Basically, every Power Five school in the country has at least one collective, and some schools actually have multiple collectives.
So with the University of Wisconsin launching, the donors and supporters of University of Wisconsin Athletics launching their Varsity Collective last week, are they late to this party, Ellen Starowski?
You know, I have to say I was very, very interested in the way that they launched it and the discussion and the rationale for the way that they rolled it out. Because they were talking about the fact that sometimes if you're first movers in a space, that that those efforts can't be sustainable. And it is going to be very, very interesting to see how these collectives survive over time. In some cases, you've got collectives that will allow like a one-time donor, for example, to give a large amount of money to the overall pool. And one does wonder if that kind of one-time donor is going to be there over a 10 or 20 year period of time, for example. Although, frankly, given where we are right now, goodness only knows if this whole framework is something that's still going to be in effect in 5 years or 10 years.
Well, Ellen, could you put the toothpaste back in the tube here? Is there a way to go back to when the student athletes were not being compensated just as we were a year ago?
Absolutely not. I would not argue that I think we're going to return to a time when athletes don't have the opportunity to get endorsements. At the same time, though, the infrastructure that is supporting all of this may or may not dramatically change. For example, there's a lot of wringing of hands right now about what this money means as it flows around the system and through the system, and whether or not all of this is really dramatically affecting recruiting, for example. In a lot of ways, the system is sort of settling into a new economic reality. And so we might expect that there's going to be this kind of uncertainty for a while. But beyond that, though, I think that we continue to have college sport officials who are looking to states and to federal legislation to help with these issues. When another way of thinking about this is to think about having a players association that advocates on behalf of the players, and that would create a different infrastructure compared to what we have right now. So it's not really surprising that we're seeing this money flow the way that it's going to flow, because we don't have that player infrastructure in place.
Ellen Starowski, our guest, professor of sports media in the Roy H. Park School of Communications at Ithaca College in upstate New York, taking a look at these collectives that have now been unleashed on over 120 schools across the country that are donors and supporters of the athletic programs in these colleges can use to help now fund, add to the income of these athletes who are enrolled in college. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234 and would be interested in your reaction as the University of Wisconsin announced, or the supporters of the University of Wisconsin Athletics announced the launch of their Varsity Collective just last week. And with the now compensation of these college collegiate athletes, Ellen, I'm wondering what some of the key storylines have been over the last year that you've seen that have stood out to you.
Yeah, I think one of the most dramatic storylines in some ways is sort of the gap between how some athletes have received a considerable amount of money, and then when we look at that in comparison to what the averages are, and I'll give you one example of this. We had a top recruit, a high school quarterback who's been recruited by the University of Tennessee, who reportedly received an $8 million deal And we've had some other stories like that. Offensive line linemen from Texas, for example, receiving offers of $50,000 per year, for instance. And the University of Miami, with a donor who contributed $7 million, that was going to be parceled out to about 100 athletes, most of them football players. So you've got that storyline that's running. And at the same time, what you also have is these averages that are being reported by a company called Open Doors. And then if you look at those averages, the average for a Division I athlete in terms of an endorsement deal was like $600. And so trying to make meaning out of exactly what's going on in the space, given that kind of, those kinds of bookends, I think really needs to be put into perspective. The other piece of this that I think might be helpful for people to think about is here we have this $15 billion industry, which is a part of a global sport media entertainment entity. Despite kind of the millions of dollars that we're talking about, that this is really a very, very small percentage of the entire amount of money that is running through this system. And even that $15 billion is just reflective of athletic departments and what their revenue streams are. And it doesn't take into account all of the other entities that are making money off of this enterprise. So whatever kind of millions we're talking about in terms of athletes, it's still a very, very small piece of this overall industry.
We're discussing compensating student athletes after last week's announcement of the launch of a donor-led name, image, likeness collective for the University of Wisconsin collegiate athletes. Ellen Starowski is our guest, and she's a professor of sports media at Ithaca College. And we'd also like to hear from you this half hour at 1-800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about compensating student athletes? And now that we're past the question of whether they should be allowed to profit from their name, image, and likeness, what ideas do you have about how that should work or how it should be regulated? Is college sports part of your life, part of your family, part of your every Saturday? Does this story affect you personally? If so, love to know your thoughts. 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email's always available to you as well at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and right now we're picking up our conversation looking at the landscape 1 year in for name, image, likeness compensation for student athletes. UW's just joined the growing number of donor-led collectives from around the country, and Ellen Starowski stays with us as our guest. She's a professor of sports media at Ithaca College and the co-author of the book College Athletes for Hire: The Evolution and Legacy of the NCAA Amateur Myth. We want to hear from you and what you think at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. And Ellen, I want to play a clip here from Senator from Alabama, Tommy Tuberville, not just the senator from Alabama, but also the former Auburn head football coach, talking about the new compensation for student athletes earlier this week on the podcast Ruthless.
And so we've got 50 states now. They're doing everything totally different. Nobody's on the same wavelength. So Joe Manchin and I have said, listen, the players are going to make money. Supreme Court said that's over. And so they're going to make money. What we're trying to do is put some organization to the rules, regulations, and give the coaches and players and parents an opportunity to have a real life instead of just every day being pummeled by recruiting and recruiters when there should be a time limit to that. So we're not trying to stop anything. We're just trying to get college sports back to some normalcy, mm-hmm. and really understand that, hey, everybody needs to be the same way. Everybody needs to go by the same rules. The money's going to be offered. The problem, again, that I would like to be able to put some kind of sense to is be able to save a lot of these sports, women's sports and Olympic sports, when it looks like in the future, if we keep going this direction, there's no money that's going to be there to help pay for some of these.
That's Senator Tommy Tuberville talking earlier this week about the compensation for student athletes. And Ellen, I'd like to get your reaction to, and there are a couple of things there, and part of that is the recruitment process that Senator Tuberville was familiar with as an Auburn football coach, and how that's been upended across the board, and how every school, if not every state, can have a little bit different idea of what this compensation package means for their students.
Yeah, we really could spend a whole 2 to 3 hours just unpacking what was in that segment. So we'll have to try to do this in 2 minutes insteadly. Number one, you know, I think underneath this effort and these pleas from college sport officials, from the NCAA, from conference commissioners, the Power Five conference commissioners responded to Senator Tuberville and to Senator Manchin. And underneath all of this actually is an attempt to get another antitrust exemption, which just brings us full circle back to the Supreme Court ruling where the NCAA was found again to have been violating antitrust law. So, at least for me, it raises a bit of a concern that they continue to want to try to get some kind of antitrust exemption especially in terms of manipulating athletes and their position within the system. I think what's also important in this conversation is that the people who are in the position of power within this conversation are the ones who are saying that there needs to be a return to normalcy. Whenever we have a labor issue where labor begins to actually realize part of their value, the response from the people who are running the show is to try to do everything they can to protect profitability while also limiting the value of labor. And so part of the dynamic of what's playing out here is sort of this characterization that somehow athlete endorsements means that, that there's evil running across the land. That's simply not true. The opportunity for athletes to get endorsements is not going to destroy women's sports. And in point of fact, I would respectfully disagree with Senator Tuberville on this. I don't think we're going to see a destruction of women's sports as a result of this. I think quite to the contrary, we're actually seeing more promotion of women's sports because of the pressure around having to promote athletes within athletic departments. So I think there are a lot of things there that are not quite the way that that I would argue them on behalf of the players themselves. And one other piece to this is that this conversation about compensation for college athletes really needs to be put within the context of a much larger set of labor issues. For instance, Senator Booker also has a proposal right now in terms of college athletes' Bill of Rights, and there's an emphasis there on health and safety standards, which are missing right now in terms of college sport. And also a medical trust that would provide for medical care and for a fund to help athletes when they're injured. So those kinds of things are actually also a part of this discussion and at stake when we're talking about how to regulate all of this.
And when we're talking about regulating all of this, some states have, some states have not. Some universities, the University of Wisconsin, has put in a name, image, and likeness policy into their, at least online and for their athletic department. And what about Senator Tuberville's take that there are 50 different states going about this 50 different ways and all the Division I schools that can have their own take? Do we need some formal regulation or as you see it, Ellen?
I think we do need some form. It's an interesting question. At some point in time, the market is going to even out. So I think that will eventually happen. But I think we have to be very careful how that how those regulations are developed and who is at the table when that's occurring. It's very interesting in all of these discussions that players themselves, there's no mechanism to have players at the table when these discussions are going on.
Well, when we talk about other athletics, we're talking about players' unions.
Yes.
Where is the Organization for Student Collegiate Athletes?
Yeah, exactly. And the closest thing to it is the National College Players Association, which frankly is also responsible for part of our conversation today, because it was Ramogi Huma, who's the executive director of that association, that really led the way for the Fair Pay to Play Act to be passed in California, and then some other laws across the United States at the state level. But that's the closest thing that we have, but it's not recognized the way that the NFLPA would be, for example.
Got a question here from Pam, who emails ideas@WPR.org to ask, what do donors or providers of funds have for options should an athlete not fulfill their side of their NIL name, image, likeness agreement? For instance, if they fail to show up at appearances or not make the required number of promotions, can they lose their income?
Talk about an uneven landscape. I think that that this is being worked out on a case by case and kind of school by school basis. So there have been some stories about athletes who, for one reason or another, may have had an agreement rescinded, for example. So that has happened, and there have been some stipulations in that regard.
Robert from Westfield wants to know whether or not the university will get some money from this student athlete endorsement package.
You know, I love that question, because the one thing that this whole system, there's been a whole cottage industry around college athlete endorsements that has grown up in a very short period of time. So we've got organizations, marketing media organizations that are representing college athletes. We have more in-house units that are now being created, or there have been partnerships. For example, the University of Southern California has partnered with an agency that will work with athletes that's going to be in-house. But along with that is the whole content creation area to expand out all of the personal brands of athletes. And all of that is within athletic departments. So we just have this huge expansion of branding, which is co-branding between the athlete and the institution. And make no mistake about the fact that the institution, the athletic department, is getting a piece of this pie, and they're going to continue to position to get a piece of the pie.
Ellen, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's been my pleasure, Lee. Thank you so much.
Ellen Starowski, professor of sports media in the Roy H. Park School of Communications at Ithaca College, talking today about the changing landscape of compensating college athletes.